Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to The Critic podcast. I am joined by Rod Dreher, a man who needs no introduction, but I will give him one. He's an American journalist who's written previously for The American Conservative, who's written such extraordinary books as The Benedict Option, who has invented the idea of the crunchy con, and who is now living in Budapest, from which he joins me. Rod, welcome.
It's great to be here. And, you know, one thing I can say about Budapest, Sebastian, is that whatever else is happening elsewhere in Europe with radicals on the street, Islamists on the street causing mayhem, it doesn't happen here in Budapest.
Is it guaranteed Islamist free? So the subject you went to Hungary, you know.
Well, you know, it really is, because when right after the October 7th Hamas attack it slaughtered 1,300 Israelis, an intelligence analyst friend back in Washington texted me and said, "We are now about to see the vindication of Viktor Orban's migration policy." And in fact, he was right, because right after that, that's when tens of thousands of people around Europe and even in North America in various cities turned out to support Hamas. And I want to make clear from the beginning of our conversation that I don't equate supporting generally the Palestinian cause with supporting Hamas, but it seems to me that after, you know, in the days immediately following this butchery in Israel, to go on the street and to demonstrate in favor generally of the Palestinians or whatever, with no criticism at all of Hamas, I think this is a distinction without a difference. And you know, what did he mean by the vindication of Viktor Orban's migration policy? He meant that Orban's firm decision going back at least to 2015, when the migration, a million or more migrants came out of the Middle East into Europe, Orban said, no, we're not going to take that here. We can't handle that here. We're not going to have it. And he was viciously criticized as racist, as hard-hearted, as all of this. Well, I think we see what my friend in Washington was saying, I think, has been proven true. The fact that it's still that Jews in Budapest are safe to walk the streets as they are not in London, as they are not in Paris, in Stockholm, and all over Europe shows that Viktor Orban was right. You may disagree. Let's talk.
Let's talk. So there's so many sort of controversies wrapped up in this horrible business of Israel and Palestine that it's very hard to know where to begin with any of these discussions. But let's just touch on, you know, the question of, you know, support for Palestine versus support for Hamas. So I do think it is necessarily to say it's complicated always feels like an understatement, but it is complicated because you've got the fact that Hamas is in political leadership in Gaza, in no small part because Israel has pursued a policy of dividing Hamas and the West, dividing Gaza and the West Bank. They've allowed the Qataris to fund Hamas with over $1 billion. You know, there was a policy in Israel that they thought, you know, that Hamas was quote unquote reasonable. This was something that a lot of people, you know, that they thought that they were containable. There is a sense in which, whilst, you know, nobody but Hamas and its supporters bears immediate responsibility for this massacre, you can understand why people feel that, you know, the question of Hamas is more complicated than just, you know, it's not like they appeared in a void, in out of a vacuum a year ago, that all of this comes from somewhere and from mistakes that have been made on many different sides.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that as soon as the fighting is over, whenever that day comes, the Israelis will have a tremendous reckoning within. I think that Netanyahu's political career is over because of this, not only because of the security breach, but because of the things you're talking about how he has used Hamas to divide the Palestinian people. That said, we have to remember that Hamas won an election in 2007, that the Palestinians of Gaza chose Hamas over Fatah, the more moderate version of Palestinian leadership. And at some point, you have to wonder, Sebastian, I mean, when are the Palestinians to be held responsible for their choices? Even that we can even recognize that they have a very hard lot. I've been to the West Bank. I do have sympathy for the Palestinians. They don't have an easy life. They do suffer from some injustices. At the same time, you know, what are the Israelis supposed to do? The first time I went to the Middle East, I went in the year 2000. The New York Post sent me to cover Pope John Paul's trip to the Holy Land. I went to the city of Bethlehem the day before the Pope made his visit there. And, you know, it's a Palestinian city. Well, I went back to Bethlehem last year, 22 years later, and it is a very different place. It does feel like a prison for the Palestinians. You have to ask yourself, though, why did that happen? It happened because of the suicide bombing coming out of there during the Intifada. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to see the Palestinians have to live that way. The Israelis don't have clean hands there. I stood on in 2022, I stood on the rooftop of a building in Bethlehem, and a European who was there doing aid work pointed out to plots of land between Bethlehem and Jerusalem that he said the Israelis were in the process of expropriating from Palestinian owners to give to Israeli settlers. If that is true, it's wrong. It is absolutely wrong. That said, we can't say that that justifies what Hamas did. And it seems to me, in watching what has gone on online and in the streets since the October 7th massacre, that we have to insist on a very bright, clear line being drawn between Hamas and what it did on October 7th and the general Palestinian cause. Yeah. Because I don't care what the cause is. If it were some political cause in North America or the UK or Europe that had nothing to do with Islam and the Palestinians, nothing can justify the barbarism that we saw on October 7th.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it does become incredibly difficult because, I mean, you know, to turn to this question of, you know, sort of anti-Semitism, there's an extraordinary kind of almost willful naivety about, you know, what attitudes toward Jews are, both amongst Palestinians and amongst the wider Arab and Islamic population, which, you know, people who live in the real world, people who know people in these communities, know that attitudes towards Jews are incredibly negative, and those negative views make very little distinction between Jews and Israelis, or Zionism and Judaism. And I think that's something we saw, you know, in Tunisia, they burned down a synagogue in reaction to this, though they didn't say, no distinction there was drawn between Jews and Israel. You know, the Jews who went to that synagogue didn't have anything to do with Israel. And you know that quite and it strikes me that you've got the situation where I've seen, you know, you're speaking from Budapest, you know, I've seen in the Western press repeatedly the claim that Hungarians are deeply anti-Semitic, that you know, mentions of Soros feed into a powerful narrative in Hungarian society that wins elections. I've seen that claim put forward many times. Yet at the same time, if you suggest something similar about what sways Palestinian elections, you will be accused mm-hmm. of racism by a substantial part of the left. And I do find this kind of double standard sort of quite extraordinary. I mean, what would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's so the attacks on Hungary and on Viktor Orban's government are so divorced from reality that you have to wonder what's really happening here. I remember the first time I was here in Budapest in the spring of 2021, spring and summer, that was the last time Israel and Hamas got into a serious fight. And there were examples of terrorism and pogroms breaking out all over Europe. Now, in those days, in order to walk from my apartment to my office, I had to go right through the Jewish quarter in Budapest. And I thought, dear Lord, am I going to have to run gauntlets of security forces, of the military, of police? I walked through the Jewish quarter and nobody was there. There were Jews. I'm talking about, you know, Jews with side curls, you know, Orthodox Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews out walking their children. They didn't have anything to worry about. Now, how do you reconcile that with the received narrative in the Western media that Hungary is a hotbed of anti-Semitism? You can't. Is there anti-Semitism in Hungary? Yes, absolutely. Just yesterday, my son was out drinking a coffee on a main thoroughfare in Budapest and saw a young man walk by wearing a t-shirt with the death's head, the Nazi death head. And he had a cap with the advertising the far right party here in Hungary. The far right party, which, by the way, is not Fidesz, the or whatever the Guardian and other media say. Fidesz, Orban's party, is center right, absolutely. And the far right went into opposition to Orban and Orban's party in the last election. Anyway, anti-Semitism is here. You don't see it so much in Budapest, but I understand it exists in the countryside. But the idea that because Viktor Orban makes an enemy of George Soros means he's anti-Semitic is just nonsense. It was George Soros, remember, who was pushing and does push open borders migration into Europe by the Third World. In the United States, since the summer of Floyd, you know, people have become, Americans have become much more sensitive to the role George Soros through his Open Society Foundation has played in electing radical left-wing district attorneys in localities around the country who are very soft on crime. So, you know, George Soros, who downplays his Jewish identity, he's a bad guy who wants bad things for Hungary. And the fact that Viktor Orban speaks out against this does not make him an anti-Semite. It makes him a sensible man and a patriot. But of course, the left-wing media and the bien pensant in Europe and North America, they rely on the fact that most people in Europe, in the UK, and in the United States have no idea what's happening in Hungary and have to depend on the media to tell them. And so when I've said this many times, that when I have people who come over from the US or the UK to Hungary, they're shocked. They're routinely shocked by what they see. They were not prepared for how normal and sensible Hungary is because they've been propagandized by the media.
Yeah, and I should say, Rod's written a very excellent piece for our November edition, now out in all good bookstores, on this exact subject. I've just, on this question of migration, a lot of people will, you know, say, you know, and, you know, we're both Christians, so, you know, don't we have a moral obligation to help refugees? And aren't what people like Viktor Orban doing, demonizing an often very vulnerable displaced population, like you think about people victimized by the Syrian civil war, you know, and refusing them a home? How could, you know, and even if there are a number of people who commit terrorism, aren't these a very small minority? These are the sort of things people will say. So how would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I think we do. We and the wealthy West do have a responsibility to help war refugees, but that doesn't mean we have to take them permanently into our countries. You know, right now there's a new book out. It just came out in the last couple of weeks. It's in the first English translation of the political essays of Renaud Camus. He's the French intellectual who is responsible for the idea of the Great Replacement. Now, I thought, because I foolishly believed the media, I thought, oh, this is a right-wing racist conspiracy theory. But then I read the book and realized that, no, Camus has been grossly misinterpreted and even slandered in the Western media. And now you can read the book and see for yourself what Camus was talking about. And Camus, by the way, is a left-wing gay atheist. But he just is somebody who got sick and tired of seeing the France that he loved and grew up in and felt comfortable in being changed radically by open borders immigration. What Camus says is not that this is a conspiracy theory, that people you know, got into back rooms and decided we're going to replace the indigenous Europeans with immigrants. No, he said it just happened because of a variety of things, of governments of the right wanting labor for factories and so forth, with the left, with their sentimental idea about, you know, diversity is our strength, and all of these things have worked together to create a situation where now European countries and Britain are filled with Islamic radicals and Muslims who believe things that are radically antithetical to living peacefully in liberal, diverse democracies. And I think that this is simply a fact that we can't overlook. And I think this is the reason why so many of the great and the good in the West demonize Viktor Orban, because he dares to say it and he dares to act on it. You got to remember, Sebastian, this guy, Orban, leads a country of almost 10 million people. They are unique linguistically in all the world, but there's nothing like the Hungarian language. They take that very seriously. And here's something that I didn't know until I started living here. If you move to Budapest, it's not going to take you long at all before people start talking about the Trianon Treaty. I didn't know what the Trianon Treaty was until I came here. Well, it was the post-World War I settlement that broke up the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And what it ended up doing was carving Greater Hungary into a bunch of small ethno-states. The Slovak part of Hungary got its own country, Slovakia. Romania got a big chunk of Greater Hungary, and so on and so forth. Now, I don't take a position on whether Trianon was wise or necessary, but I do recognize that it led to a tremendous psychological trauma for the Hungarian people. They saw two-thirds of their nation carved away. And the result of all this, even today, when you talk to young Hungarians, they all feel it. The result of this is they felt that this country cannot allow itself to fall under the domination of foreign powers, because the foreign powers will abuse it. Now, again, you don't have to take a position on Trianon to recognize it. This is something that is deeply, deeply felt by the Hungarians. And so when they are told that they must accept into their country a large number of people who don't share their language, who don't share their culture, they feel that this is once again the powerful West telling them that they need to surrender their country. And frankly, I sympathize with that view.
You see, I mean, a few things going on there. I mean, and one thing I find very interesting is this is, in fact, some of the parallels here, because, of course, one is, of course, inherently very sympathetic to the plight of Palestinians who've lost large parts of their historic homeland. But I'm also struck by the fact, if you look at, countries like Hungary, Poland, who, around, in fact, a similar time to Palestine, lost much of their territorial land. Poland was moved about several hundred miles west. Much of the population was killed. Hungary, they lost two-thirds of their historical borders. These countries have, it's notable that, the shapes that something like Polish or Hungarian nationalism have taken, I mean, they've changed over time, sometimes have involved violence, but, we haven't seen something comparable to Hamas arising in lots of other dispossessed peoples. So I do think there's a sort of failure to sort of deal with what's actually going on ideologically. There's this kind of assumption that they're only oppressed and oppressors, and that they and the oppressors and oppressed must all be roughly the same. Oppressed are similar, all oppressors are similar to one another.
Yeah, two things there. The other night here in Budapest, I was having a conversation with someone from Central Europe. I forgot, not Hungarian, but he said that, what are the Palestinians on about? He said after World War II, there were massive population transfers in Eastern and Central Europe. I mean, this was a tremendous trauma for not just Hungarians, but for everybody. That's right. This was a Pole I was talking to. He said that my parents were left stateless by all this. And this is something that is part of the personal history of within living memory of hundreds of thousands and even millions of Europeans. Doesn't make it right what happened to the Palestinians, but what happened to the Palestinians is not unique at all. And it is only seen as unique in the modern world because we've lost our memory, our cultural memory. Population transfer is a horrible thing, but it's real. I remember talking to, when I first came here to Hungary, talking to an American of Hungarian descent who lives here. And I was trying to get him to explain to me why Trianon is such a painful subject for contemporary Hungarians 100 years later. And he said, it's as simple as this. If I want to go visit my grandparents' grave, I have to go abroad. And something as simple and as personal as that brings it all home. And it makes me understand, too, why the Palestinians feel so much grief here. But at the same time, as you point out, Sebastian, you don't see the Bohemian Liberation Front, staging attacks to get back territory that was ceded to Poland or whatever. I'm just pulling that out of my head. I don't know. But, you know, we have to live in history. We have to look forward. And if you're going to live in peace, we can't go back and, you know, and relitigate and refight history, or we will constantly be at war. Now, go ahead.
Sorry, the thing I'm struck by, though, is a difference between something like Palestine or Poland, and Poland is that Poland was given, you know, however flawed, a functional state, even if that state was under Soviet influence for a very long time. You know, they did have their own state. They had their own territory, their own government, their own laws, their own infrastructure. There was an ability to take another path. And the thing that I'm so struck by is that both Palestinian and Israeli leaders collaborate in not giving and not seeking Palestinian statehood. You think you have, you know, Arafat refusing the deal back at Camp David, you know, but at the same time, lots of Israelis were also opposed to that deal. There's a sense in which if Palestinians are either allowed by Israel to settle down or choose themselves to settle down and stop building prosperity, stop building a functional state, then, you know, then the kind of logic of the conflict starts to unravel.
Right, right. But we have to remember, too, that the Israelis accepted the UN partition. They were prepared to live with the Palestinian state next to them, but the Arab leaders told the Palestinians, "We're coming to save you. We're going to take care of Israel." And you know, it's a cliche at this point, but if Israel dropped its defenses, you know, to let the Palestinians thrive, there wouldn't be any Israel. I hate to sound like a robot there, but it really is true. Hamas showed us what happens if there is no Israel, what will happen to Jews in Palestine. We have to keep in mind that if you read the Hamas charter, they don't want a Palestinian state. They don't want peaceful coexistence. They want the elimination of Israel. And we see this on the streets with the, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Do people in the West not know what that means?
The West will chant that. And if they're pressed on it, they'll say, well, we need to get rid of the apartheid state of Israel and people just need to live next to each other in a single state or something. And there's very little. I often think there's a lot about the silence, the things that aren't said. That, like, I haven't seen one, you know, really strong pro-Palestine advocate, you know, be able to answer the question of what, you know, if you think Israel's an apartheid state that needs to be, that is inherently unjust, you know, like one of our MPs, you know, Chris Williams, and our former MPs, Chris Williams, and we're saying, you know, we need to get rid of Israel. What happens to the Jews? I've never seen a single person answer that question. And I find the lack of answer to that question, you know, to call it disturbing doesn't, you know, it doesn't cover it.
Right. Well, if we're going to use the word apartheid, look at what has happened to South Africa in the 30 years since apartheid ended. I think you and I both agree that apartheid was monstrously unjust and had to end. But this idea that so many Western liberals had of this rainbow diversity as our strength, Mandela state that was going to emerge, it hasn't happened. And in fact, now you have the leader of the second or third largest Black party in South Africa leading the song Kill the Boers. And you see horrific racism, anti-white racism going on in South Africa with Black militants slaughtering white farmers. This is not a good thing, but these are the things that don't often make it into the Western media because it doesn't confirm our liberal narrative, our progressive narrative of the way the world is supposed to be.
Yeah, see, and on this question of, you know, these kind of furious ethno-nationalisms that we're seeing play out across so many countries, I do sort of have a question for you about nationhood, because, I mean, we met for the first time at, I think, the National Conservative Conference in Brussels. And I think I would certainly say, you know, as a sort of someone who's, you know, sort of very interested in political philosophy, that there's a clear link between liberalism, democracy and nationalism, that, you know, sort of, you look at the 19th century, you know, the idea of of a nation of that has a sort of ethnic population that then votes for policies, that's the kind of liberal paradigm. And I'm struck by things like, for example, in Hungary, you know, what you've seen, the violence in the Balkans, the kind of the resentments and divisions of movements of people in Central Europe, that thing of having to cross the border to see your grandfather's grave. All of those things have been wrought by the disintegration of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the sort of, isn't there a sense in which, you know, if conservatives attach themselves to nationalism, are they not also attaching themselves to a kind, you know, to a sort of rationalistic liberal paradigm as well? One that sort of, you know, you're forced to create that border.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that nationalism itself is rooted in certain realities about human consciousness, about human culture. Here in Hungary, I mean, I'm a migrant here. I'm living here at the sufferance of the Hungarians. And if they choose to send me away, that's their business, you know, and I can't contest that. But the reason I think that things work so well here, generally speaking, it's not paradise. It's a normal country, but we don't have these sort of conflicts that are you see in France and Sweden and in the UK, is because there is a certain homogeneity here. Because people, whatever their conflicts, and they're very bitter, this is a very politically divided place, they don't break along ethnic lines and tribal lines. Last night, my son and I, who lives with me here in Budapest, we went to see the new Martin Scorsese film, Killers of the Flower Moon, about the murders of the Osage Indians in 1920s Oklahoma. And we were talking on the way back about how the whites in that time and place did not see the Indians as fully human. And they felt that they were entitled to kill them and abuse them because they were not like us, quote unquote, like us. And the Leonardo DiCaprio character in the film is a white man who is married to an Osage woman. And he betrays her. He participates in, and this is not a spoiler, but he participates in the killing of other Indians because he wants their money and his family wants their money. Now, I had to explain to my son that in tribalism is such a powerful thing that in the Rwandan genocide in the 1990s, you had Hutu spouses killing or permitting to be killed their Tutsi spouses, you know, because the feeling of tribalism was even greater than within marriage. Now, I bring that up in this discussion to say that, you know, we have to bear in mind that we're not, people are not brains in vats. You know, we, in the United States, we love to say that we're a nation built on an idea, and it's an idea that has so far worked out, but we're also going up against the limits of that idea. You can only really live in a diverse, pluralistic society if everyone or most everyone there accepts the deal that we're all equal under the law and we have to be tolerant within the bounds of classical liberalism. What we're living with now, though, is that the way that leftism and progressivism has developed into this oppressor versus oppressed, fundamentally Marxist category, is destroying the capacity for liberalism to work and is actually, I think, giving rise to the vicious negative form of nationalism, not the positive form that Yoram Hazony and the NatCons like to talk about the, something that builds a positive solidarity, but rather a negative solidarity where people turn on their neighbors because they're not part of the same tribe.
So, I mean, if we want, I mean, do you think that homogeneity is the only response to tribalism? Because isn't it, in a sense, quite a sort of a kind of resigned perspective that, you know, yes, you may argue, you know, opening all the borders would be utopian madness. But on the other hand, you know, obviously, societies like America have been very successful off the back of quite a large degree of pluralism. I mean, do you think that there are six? I mean, do you think that homogeneity suits some countries but not others? Do you think that there are different models than the sort of failed ones we often see in European countries?
Yeah, you know, this is the real political question of our time, I think. You know, as you know from reading my stuff, I'm deeply impressed by the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre's observation from the early 1980s that the West is falling apart because we have lost the thing that united us. And I don't believe MacIntyre laid it out in that time so clearly, but we've lost Christianity, that even though we fought in the West bitter, bitter, bloody battles over Protestantism versus Catholicism, things like that, nevertheless, we generally as a civilization look to the Bible as our common story. But when you have a large number of people imported into your country from, say, the Islamic world who don't look to the Bible, who look to the Quran, You can't tell these people you have to leave your religion behind. Mm-hmm. You have a right to expect them to subordinate their religion and their religious beliefs to the broader settlement that has brought us peace, secularism and liberalism that has brought us peace. Now, as a committed Christian, there are a lot of things that I chafe at in the face of secularism and liberalism. But at the same time, I don't see any other way in which we can live in peace and tolerance and pluralism. The question is, though, that what we call liberalism, meaning, you know, progressivism, the left-wing politics, seems to have thrown that behind, thrown that away, and sees now everything as power relations. I think that probably explains why we have a lot of the stuff we've seen since Hamas did what it did. I don't know about you, but the most frightening thing I have seen since October 7th are the polls showing that in the United States, and I'm sure it's parallel in Britain, a majority of the people, adults 18 to 29, I believe, say that what Hamas did could be justified because of Palestinian suffering. Now, why that's so terrifying to me is it says that if they are willing to believe that atrocities like cutting the unborn children out of the bellies of their mothers and then massacring their mothers, if that is permissible to achieve a political goal, where does it stop? They're going to turn on us next. That's my great fear.
Yeah, you see, I mean, on this, one thing I'm very struck by is the way that there's, you know, if what is the way that we're so, the odd thing is that even as we've in theory globalized, you know, in economic and demographic terms, I feel like intellectually, analytically, we've turned inwards. So there's a sense which, you know, if the kind of thing that was happening to the Islamic world and that's happened to the Islamic world over the last 50 or 70 years was happening to the West, even in a small way, even in a few countries, you know, if there were Christian, you know, regimes that were doing a fraction of the things that Islamist regimes, Islamic regimes were doing, it would be the greatest moral panic ever to grip the liberal world. We would see, like, Donald Trump wouldn't touch it, you know, we would hear, you know, Viktor Orban, forget about him. There was one Christian country behaving the way that, you know, Saudi Arabia did. That country would be the villain of the world. You know, you think about how Russia, which sort of, you know, plays around with Christian nationalism, you know, the way that's exaggerated, you know, and I can't stand Russia, but it's a kind of secular nationalist power at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It's not a Christian, it's not really a Christian regime.
Yeah.
You know, I think of myself, in the Islamic world has undergone a complete transformation, you know, from Wahhabism to Diabandi in Pakistan to the rise of the Islamic Republic in Iran. I mean, you know, the kind of complete dwindling away of the Arab secular nationalists, you know, the rise of Islamist parties across the Middle East. This transformation, you know, it sort of came into the public glare in a very naive way with the war on terror, which was the worst possible response to it. But now we've all sort of forgotten about it again. Our civilizational transformation has happened next door to us, and we can't even talk about it.
Right. You know, I'm reminded hearing you talk about what happened to me in the newsroom at the Dallas Morning News, where I was working at the time of the London subway bombings. You might remember that about 20 years ago. I heard the news breaking in the U.S. on my drive into work, and I went to the morning news meeting. And they were trying to decide how can we cover this. And I brought up the fact that I had been doing a lot of reporting on radical Islam in the North Texas area. And I said, we're probably going to find out that the bombers were homegrown British Muslims. And immediately, one of the most liberal editors in the newsroom jumped forward and said, oh, you always hear about Islamic terrorism, Islamic radicalism. Why don't we ever hear about Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and, you know, these right-wing American evangelical Christians? And it's such a knee-jerk thing that I realized that the media class and the liberal ruling class in the West sees everything through its own personal battles. In the U.S., the greatest enemy is to the left are evangelical Christians. And therefore, any Christian who is massacred in Nigeria, in the Middle East, anywhere, are automatically little Falwells and little Robertsons. You know, It's insane, but that's how we can explain things. That's how we can understand things.
Yeah, and again, I wouldn't want to downplay the evils of white nationalist kit shooters and things, but you know, to put this in perspective, you know, the victims number usually in the dozens. You know, I think I've seen cited something like 20,000 people a year are killed in jihadist violence, and most of those people are, you know, Muslims. They're not, you know. I mean, the idea that there is any comparison, it just becomes completely absurd.
Yeah, it is. But this is how it goes now. It's like in the post-summer of Floyd in the United States, you know, the only violence, interracial violence, it seems to matter to the media is when a white person, usually a police officer, does something unjust and violent to a person of color. Meanwhile, you know, if you're online, you can see every day a new video of a large number of young Black people sacking a store, robbing a store, or beating up Asians and so forth. But we can't talk about that in the media, and it is completely unrealistic. And what it ends up doing, Sebastian, and I'm seeing this happen in real time, is it feeds white nationalism. It feeds radical right-wing people who believe that they can see that proper liberals, liberals of the right, liberals of the left, who won't stand up and talk about what's right in front of their faces, if they won't defend this, then they'll go, these people will go and listen to the hard right, true race haters who will. And just this morning, I was reading something that I put in my book, Live Not by Lies, about the rise of totalitarian sentiment in the West. It was a quote from Solzhenitsyn, who said, I think this was from Gulag Archipelago, he said that if you had gone to all these proper late 19th century Russian intellectuals and said within 20, 30 years in this country, tortures that had not been seen here since the Middle Ages would be common and so on and so forth, they would have thought you were nuts. They would have wanted you hauled off to an insane asylum, because the skull is always just beneath the skin. And if we in the West are now starting to excuse the sort of barbarism that Hamas did because it was the oppressed standing up against the oppressor, then we are signing the death warrant of our own civilization.
So, and this fury of the oppressed must always be valid, must always be justified. I mean, it is a very disturbing worldview. I mean, where do you think that comes from? I mean, how is something that simplistic sort of taken hold of, you know, our sophisticated, you know, civilization?
You know, I think that a lot of it goes back to the early 20th century and the rise of what the American sociologist and cultural critic Philip Reeve called the triumph of the therapeutic. Mm. Now, Reeve said that in his cultural theory, the modern West got rid of religious man, as he put it, you know, in the 19th century, he died, and he's been replaced by psychological man, which is to say that someone who judges good and evil on the basis of how it feels. Now, you've had other thinkers like Alistair MacIntyre, the aforementioned Alistair MacIntyre, who talked about the rise of emotivism. That's MacIntyre's word, which is the same thing, to determine good or evil on the basis of how it feels. Well, there is, we've also, as the late René Girard put it, have come to this sort of weird place where the victim, the sort of hyper-Christianity, where the victim is a source of power, victimhood is a source of power. And so we have gone from, over the course of the 20th century, we created a culture in the West in which sympathy for the victim is a sign, people who suffer is a sign of moral worth. Now, if within a proper Christian culture, we would sympathize with people who are oppressed, with the outsider, with those who are put upon, but we also would recognize that the capacity for evil is within all of us. As Solzhenitsyn famously said, what he learned in the Gulag was that the line between good and evil does not run between peoples or between political parties, but right down the middle of every human heart. That is a foundational truth of human nature that you get out of the Bible. But we've lost that. And when you create a situation or a culture in which people are treated differently on the basis of their alleged victimhood, then you've laid the groundwork for this sort of thing. I can remember back in the 90s when Spike Lee, the Black filmmaker, was rising to prominence. He made headlines by making claims like Black people can't be racist because racism involves power. You know, well, that's awfully convenient because it means that people like Spike Lee don't have to examine their own consciences to see if they are, if they harbor hatred for people of other races or religions. And I think that this has now become that toxic hermeneutic for interpreting culture has become very general. And it's always been there, a temptation in the human character. But now, as we have abandoned liberalism proper, classical liberalism and liberal standards, this has become common.
Yeah, and I'm struck by the fact that this sort of victim idea, this worship of the victim, in a sense, is Christian, but it's also very much post-Christian, because, of course, the entire philosophy of Christianity is all about how you, despite being victimized, have to act, have these kind of powerful moral obligations. If somebody strikes you, let them strike also the other cheek. If somebody, you know, here, give them your cloak. You know, you're supposed, that Christianity is a religion of the victim, which the victim is not supposed to meet the oppressor with violence. So that ethic has gone right out the window.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know why? Because it works. It works to get political power. One of the most chilling things I saw earlier this year was a speech Donald Trump gave to a group of his supporters, where he said, "I am your retribution."
Yeah.
I mean, and it's chilling because you can understand exactly why that would appeal to people. If the people who follow Trump, the deplorables who are correct that they're looked down on by Harvard and the New York Times and cultural elites, they really are. But you can't allow that to poison you. You can't allow that sense of victimhood to take hold in your soul, because you will end up justifying any number of crimes because you are the victim.
Yeah, and on all this question of justification, I'm interested in, you know, you're speaking from Hungary, you've written about Orban. You know, why do you think that some claims of victimhood get authorized over others, whatever the sort of evidence of the extent of it might be? So, for example, you know, Eastern and Central Europe were under a totalitarian system for much of their history up until 30 years ago. Hungary, as you mentioned, lost much of its territory. Yet there's very little sense I get from the Western press of much sympathy or interest in the problems suffered by people in Eastern Europe. It's a sense their victimhood is, you know, it certainly seems to sort of attract less sympathy than the victimhood of people in many other countries and continents.
Oh, of course, yeah, because they're abstractions. I mean, one of the reasons that people in the West despise Viktor Orban is because he is not on the progressive track on LGBT rights, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, here in Hungary, same-sex couples can get a civil partnership, but they can't have marriage. And infamously, a couple of years ago, the Hungarian government passed a law forbidding what they consider to be the propagandization of minors, children and minors, for gender ideology and things like that. I mean, there was a huge scandal in Europe. Mark Rutte, then the prime minister of the Netherlands, said that Hungary should be kicked out of the EU and so on and so forth. Well, I think that there are a lot of people in the West proper parents who would be grateful to be able to send their children to school without having the teachers go at their seven-year-olds and try to convince them that they might really be the opposite sex. But leaving that aside, Hungary is a more conservative society than the UK, for example, or Sweden. They're very much a Western society. They're not a terribly religious society. Only fewer than 10% of the people in Hungary are in church on Sunday, but they're culturally conservative. And yet you can, I live here in Budapest, it's common to see lesbian couples walking, holding hands, gay couples. You're fine here. You're not going to get beat up on the street. Now, I bring this up because, you know, for all our pretense for diversity, we support diversity in the West, the right of the Hungarian people to set their own policy about what marriage means and what sort of information will be presented to their children in school and in the public square why can't we tolerate them? The Hungarians have no desire to make Britain or Sweden or France follow Hungary's rules. Why can't we tolerate that for Hungary?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing that I'm struck by, and I promise this is the last time I'll go to this particular well, is it's the differential treatment. Like, if you look at somewhere like Palestine, there's been polling on social attitudes there. Now, this is a society in which homosexuality is illegal, in which, you know, many Islamic societies, homosexuals are put to death. The attitudes, the average Palestinian are that this is right, that this should be the case, that, you know, this is overwhelming, even, you know, and the attitude of most Western audiences is of, well, these are, you know, they won't say it, but what they're thinking is these are backward societies. Mm-hmm. You know, these are non-white backward societies. Obviously, they're going to be behind us on these things. Whereas I do feel like a lot of this is a kind of liberal paternalistic racism, whereby white, quote unquote, white countries like Israel, like Hungary, are expected to have the same values and policies and are held to the same expectations as Western European countries that would be. So they say, you know, well, you have to be where we are, and you have to have the same attitude, and you can't defend yourself, and no, you can't be where Britain was in the 1980s, you know, is Hungary, that's not allowed. Whereas their attitude towards African and Middle Eastern societies is sort of, well, you know, they're savages on the long path towards civilization, and really, if there's they're victimized, and really they're colonized. And of course, even if they do have these attitudes, and even if they do have these laws, they will blame them. And this actually, he actually said, well, obviously the reason Palestinians oppress homosexuals is because they see gay is because of anti-gay laws from the British Empire.
I mean,
and this is the sort of worldview. I know the Dems are the real racist, gets very annoying, and it's very worldview. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I usually don't want to go all into it, but there are some cases where it really is quite clearly racist, and it's quite clearly the heir to the kind of liberal imperialism of a J.S. Mill or something. It really, mm-hmm. like, there's an obvious paternalism there that just, you can't, that much of the left just seems completely blind to.
Right, right. Well, that Milan Kundera in The Unbearable Lightness of Being wrote about what makes a leftist is the ability to fold any event into the grand march of progress towards, you know, universal brotherhood and liberty and so on and so forth. Well, I think we could similarly say that what makes a leftist is the ability to fold anything around the world, any event, any phenomenon, any people into the great sense of combat against right-wingers in their own societies. And that's what we're seeing here. I mean, the whole gays for Gaza, you know, queers for Palestine, it's like chickens for KFC. I mean, seriously, it's just insane. That if you were a gay Palestinian, you would want to get to Israel or to Hungary as fast as you possibly could, because you can live a peaceful life, even among people who may not agree with your sexuality, but they're not going to kill you for it. They're not going to oppress you for it. But this is something that our left in the UK, in the US, and in Europe just refuse to see, because they're so captive to narrative. Narrative is everything. And look, this is, you might remember that after World War II, some of the Allied troops took German civilians living in the vicinity of concentration camps, took them into the concentration camp so they could be forced to see what was done to the Jews and other captives in their name. I think this is why it's so important to put these horrific pictures and accounts of the Hamas atrocities in front of Palestinian apologists and sympathizers in the West. The other day, I was involved in a text exchange with a friend of mine who is an old friend who was very sympathetic to the Palestinians and was barraging me with text about the poor Palestinians. And I didn't want to get into it with him, but I just sent him back a picture of the Israeli pathologist. You might have seen this online, showing he had a picture in front of him of the burned corpse, unrecognizable corpse of a man and a child, or an adult and a child, who were bound together by Hamas and set on fire. They died embracing each other. I sent that to him with no comment, and he got very angry. He said, What made you think I wanted to see that sort of thing? How dare you send that to me? And because I sent it to you because you needed to see what ultimately you are euphemizing or abstracting out of existence. This is what you are defending. You don't think you're defending it, but you are.
Yeah, and I mean, it is striking as well that we haven't, is that Islamic extremism is not something, you know, you sometimes get people saying, oh, it's you know, 50, you know, and I do think, this is where I actually do think people get Islamophobic. They suggest that Islam has been barbarous for 1500 years, you know, and this is a, you know, and Islam is also, you know, something that's built a civilization with art, music, medicine, poetry, you know. I think that in a sense, the barbarism has happened in the last 100 or even 50 years. You know, that something like these tactics, which people, you know, which affected the tactics of ISIS, are things that are, they're, you know, they're worse even than what Al-Qaeda was doing. And that Al-Qaeda was doing things that were worse than what earlier Islamist movements were doing. We're actually seeing, you know, Islamism become more, it's a deeply modern movement, and I think it's becoming more totalitarian, more violent, you know, more nationalistic.
It is. And as we see in France in particular with the so-called Islamo-gauchiste phenomenon, where the far left is teaming up with Islamic politicians to resist the right. This is suicidal for the left, because as soon as the Islamists, should they come to power, the first thing they're going to do is go after the gays and Jews and anybody else who gets on the left, who gets in the way of their agenda. It's just insane. The Islamists are using the left as pawns to come to power, and but the left being so enamored of its narrative, and the narrative which says that the religious right or the conservatives must always be the villains, the Tories must always lose, that has such a death grip on the mind of the left. And by the way, you know, they, even though Rishi Sunak has been very good on this issue, the Tories have overseen in your country mass immigration, you know, in their 13 years of rule, and it's hard for me to see how they've been effectively conservative on much of anything. So this is not simply a problem of the left. We have it in the U.S. on the right too. You know, for all of the huffing and puffing about the Trumpist and others on the right about the migration problem, the border is still wide open, even though we've had conservative governance for off and on for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, and I do feel like, you know, we're talking about, you know, sort of Western countries, Islamism, nationalism. I do feel like we're sort of looking at these two civilizational projects. And on the one hand, we've got post-Christendom, the post-Christendom West, which sort of is no longer able to even defend or articulate the liberal project in positive terms. And then we've got this kind of, you know, post-Islamic Islamist civilizational project that is only which is, you know, just as negatively articulating Islam as a kind of decolonial nationalism, you know, with kind of ultra violence and a kind of totalitarian rewrite of Sharia law. Mm-hmm. And I just feel that there's a failure of modern thinkers to be able to, and certainly policymakers, to be able to articulate policy in civilizational terms, to think about, you know, what kind of citizens do we want to produce? What sort of ideas do we want to govern us?
Yeah, yeah. We don't talk about that anymore. I think we're afraid of it. Like, you know, our universities, it's a truism now on the right to say that the universities have been captured, but seriously, when you have the heights of intellectual culture in the West, these citadels of culture, who are engaged in this massive act of cultural harakiri, you know, by tossing out Shakespeare and Dante and all these others because they're tainted by colonialism or whiteness and all that. I mean, it's insane. We won't even defend ourselves against ourselves, much less against radical Islam. It's hard to know where it goes because, you know, liberalism itself, in the sense that most people are liberal, classical liberalism, it seems to be a dead man walking right now. And God knows what's going to come next, whether it's of the radical right or the radical left. This does have the feeling of being a lot like Spain in the early 1930s, hurtling towards an abyss that nobody really wants, but nobody can figure out how to stop.
I mean, you know, looking at all of these problems, you know, and you've mentioned, you know, Tory failures of migration, the Conservative role in mass migration as well. I mean, do you think there's a sense in which, faced with these kind of challenges, there's a need to, you know, reach across, you know, right-left divides, to reach across, you know, maybe across religious divides, you know, how do Christians and Muslims talk to each other? How do leftists and rightists talk to each other? You know, do you think that there's a kind of project of reconciliation there?
Yeah, I hope so. We desperately need it. You know, when I was doing interviews for Live Not By Lies, I spoke to this woman, Camilla Bendova. Camilla, she's still alive. She and her late husband, Václav, were the only Christians in the inner circle of Václav Havel and the top Czech dissidents. And I asked her if it was difficult for her and for her husband. They were both strict Catholics and political conservatives, to work with Havel and all these hippies who were part of the movement, because they were like exchanging wives and had pretty loose lives. And Camilla said, no, not at all, Rod, because the important thing to realize when you're facing totalitarianism is the rarest quality to find in a person is courage. Mm. These hippies, she told me, they had it. We knew that they would stand by us no matter what. They would take care of our kids if we went to jail. And they knew they could count on that from me and my husband. So many of our fellow Christians just kept their head down to avoid trouble. So you always need to reach out and work across political and confessional lines to find those who stand on the right side and who have courage. This has been one of the most encouraging things to me personally with my Live Not By Lies project, is people like Brett Weinstein, Heather Hying, you know, on the left, atheist, but anti-woke, Peter Boghossian, Barry Weiss. They're all people I wouldn't agree with politically or culturally on a lot of things, but they're all good people who will stand up for liberty, for decency, for tolerance, but also they're intolerant towards the totalitarians. I think we desperately need that sort of thing. And it's also the case, Sebastian, I've been thinking a lot in recent days about in the days immediately following 9/11 and the months following 9/11, I was working in New York as a journalist and I was pretty hard on radical Islam. A friend of mine who at the time, she's an Orthodox Jew who would go undercover to Islamist conventions in North America, totally veiled, to do research for counterterrorism. She said, Rod, you got to be careful about this because we and our organization could not do our work if not for so many Muslims who hate what they're seeing, but can't speak out on it because some of them would actually literally be killed for what they're doing, or they would end up losing face in the community, maybe losing their jobs, losing contact with family members. So they're very quiet and they reach out to us to help us know who the bad guys are, but you'll never know their names. Now, I hope these people, we need to embolden them and make it possible for them to speak out. I don't think that we should tolerate, as a general rule, Islamic silence in the face of these atrocities. But we also need to remember that there are people within organizations, within mosques, within religious organizations and otherwise, who may agree with us, but who may not have the liberty to speak out. We can't make blanket condemnations of entire groups of people.
No, and I think also in the way, in the war on terror of the neoconservative project, you know, and before it, many Muslims felt they were faced the choice between secular, liberal, nationalism, progressivism, or Islamism. Often the secular, national, liberal project was also linked to dictatorship, whereas many times Islamism has been linked with democratic and republican movements, as with the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, that doesn't mean that they're good actors, but, you know, I mean, that dimension has not been considered enough. And that, you know, people like Erdogan have come to power off the back of, you know, rural Muslim conservative people. And, you know, often, you know, they've been quite, sometimes they're quite effective at providing, you know, local services. Like, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's actually an Anglican priest out in Turkey, and he's no fan of Erdogan, but he says, you know, he's bought a hospital in every village, pretty much. You know, this is, he's delivered for a group of people who were not being delivered for under, you know, the largely urban nationalist governments that came before him.
Well, two things about that you also hit on one of the reasons for Viktor Orban's success and the reason that he won a landslide fourth term in last year's elections. It wasn't because he cheated. It was because the people outside of central Budapest are conservative, and he speaks for them. He's a country boy, basically. He's one of the smartest politicians I've ever seen in terms of raw intelligence, but he is also a man of the country. Somebody told me, a Hungarian, that one of the key things to know about Viktor Orban is that he was a student leader against the communists, and he made his reputation by giving this very brave speech in 1988, a public speech telling the Russians to get out of his country. This is when the communists were still in power. So he's got guts. But after the fall of communism, there was some big event here in Budapest where all the proper liberals were on stage congratulating each other. And onto the stage comes young Viktor Orban in his early 20s. And whoever was the grand old man of the proper Budapest liberals walked over to him on stage in front of everybody else and straightened Orban's tie to humiliate him and put him in his place and let him know that he's a country boy and he'll never really be one of us. Viktor Orban never forgot about that. And the people who vote for Viktor Orban know that too. And so that accounts for a lot of his support. And this is something that liberals and progressives ought to remember, that people like Orban often speak for the masses who have been marginalized by ruling elites. Now, secondly, I wonder what you were talking about, the choice between secular liberalism and fundamentalism. Back in 2006, I was at an Arab media conference in Dubai, and I met a woman, an Egyptian woman who was working somewhere in the British media. She was an immigrant from Cairo. And she said, you know, my husband and I really, really don't know where to turn. You know, we don't want our girls to go to British schools because the values that are there on sexuality and everything else are really abhorrent to us. We're Muslims. At the same time, we're not fundamentalists. We don't want our girls to be raised in Islamic fundamentalist schools, but that's the only choice we have here. Where do we turn? Yeah. I think there have to be a lot of people out there like that who, you know, and we see them in America too. One of the things that has been encouraging to me actually in recent months is to see how Muslim parents in Michigan and elsewhere have been the ones with the courage to stand up to the people who want to bring transgender education into public schools. The Muslim parents are like, no, you can't do that to our kids. So many Christian parents are so desperately afraid of being called bigots or losing middle-class face that they won't dare to stand up. But the Muslims do, and God bless them for that. I really hate that what's happened now in between Israel and Palestine may fracture the beginning of what was a useful, practical alliance.
Why do you think that liberalism was once so successful at dealing with people who had much more liberal values and much more conservative values living alongside each other? You know, like there was an acceptance in the past, I feel, that there were conservative communities, that there would be parents who would want to teach much more conservative values for their children. There were teachers who would have, there were parents would have different views. Why has there been this sudden narrowing whereby it's considered utterly unacceptable to tolerate the existence of, you know, a community with different values? Why is that kind of ideological pluralism so suddenly kind of gone out the window? You know, I mean, even as late as the 1990s, I'd say that wasn't the case. And now,
That is something that I think about a lot. I remember I moved to Washington, D.C. in 1992 at the start of my journalism career. And I come from the state of Louisiana, which at that time was still mostly a Democratic state, but the Democrats were what we called back then blue dog Democrats. They tended to be socially conservative. But people generally got along, you know, it wasn't a paradise, but people didn't make politics into their be all and end all. Then I got to Washington and I was shocked to find so many of my the liberals I would hang out with or in my social groups, they tended to be driven fiercely by politics, and not just politics, but a puritanical kind of politics where they didn't want to be associated with people who believed things that they thought were wrong. Now, this was so strange to a lot of my conservative friends, and because a lot of us had come from states where, you know, everybody gets together and has a beer at the end of the day. And politics aren't religion. That's not how the left saw it back then. well, now what was just the sort of a mentality that was confined to young Capitol Hill staffers and NGO activists in the 1990s seems to have become very general. And look, it's not just liberals now. Conservatives behave the same way.
So, yeah, I think you've put your finger on it. Politics has become religion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that in the past, you know, liberalism, as you mentioned earlier, it emerges precisely as a compromise between different religious groups. You know, so liberals were traditionally kind of, you know, I mean, at least in Britain, were more likely to be kind of nonconformist Christians, who were often very conservative in their own communities, but then didn't necessarily believe in legislating it nationally. There were different views. And now and the sense is that kind of bracketing of, you know, private religious communities, public liberal values, you know, once the liberal values have become the religion, the bracketing goes away.
Yeah. And how do you put it back together? This is what worries me. I remember a few years ago when I was getting ready to go to Spain on a book tour, I wanted to learn more about the Spanish Civil War. So went on YouTube, and there's this fantastic 6-part documentary series from Granada Television from the 1980s about the Spanish Civil War. I expected it to be biased to the left, but it actually wasn't. It was pretty balanced. And I watched the first episode, which, you know, listeners can go find this easily on YouTube. And the first episode was a prelude to the conflict. And it was scary, Sebastian, to watch this play out about how when the Republic was declared, some of the radical left started burning down churches and convents. Then when the right got back into power at the next election, they paid them back. And it went back and forth like this until you get to 1935. And the party, both sides are at each other's throats. They did an interview, there's a quote from a phalangist, a far rightist, because these people were still alive in the 80s when they were interviewed. And he said, by 1935, if we were sitting at this, our people, the right, was sitting at a cafe and we saw a socialist or a communist walk by, we thought we were looking at the devil. And they felt the same way about us. And a year later, you know, the war is on. Well, I don't know what a civil war would look like in 21st century America or Britain, but I have this chilling feeling that we're going to find out.
Okay. Let's see. I mean, what do you think the way forward is, if there is one? Even if it isn't civil war, you know, civil dysfunction and like long, you know, like an entropy and like constant division is, you know, that can do, is maybe not the damage of a civil war, but, you know, like there are entire countries that have been vaguely dysfunctional for 100 years without descending into civil war. That can be almost as bad. Like you're like, you know, like a lot, like everything is just get steadily worse.
There's a great deal of ruin in a nation or whatever the line was. Yes. It's really hard to say. I'm pretty black-pilled about things at this point. But, you know, I came up with this concept a few years ago called the Benedict option, you know, which is unlike what people who've never read the book say. It's not about we all have to head for the hills and hunker down, because I take it for granted that, you know, we live in post-Christian societies and people who want to maintain the Christian faith in any small orthodox form have to do so in tight communities, living in the world. That said, I think that it's becoming ever more apparent that this is the only way forward, that there is not going to be any sort of grand solution where we vote for this party and that gets things sorted. I think what we're more likely to go to head for is some sort of managed technocracy, soft totalitarian technocracy, where in order to keep the proles from revolting, we're going to have to use, or our elites are going to use, some form of the social credit system. I think that COVID and what the Canadians did with the Canadian truckers is a sign of what's likely to be our future, that, you know, in order to maintain civil order, they're going to use all kinds of means that the Chinese are already employing. They're going to be employed on us, and it's going to be sold to us as the sort of thing we need to do for the sake of democracy and freedom and so on and so forth. We're going to have Patriot Act 2 or something like that. I just feel like that this is going to be our future. I hope it's not our future, but it does feel like the walls are closing in and I don't see any way out, because when you have, and certainly with your generation, not you, Sebastian, but you know, men and women of your generation, in my country, a majority of whom you know, believe that what Hamas did was within the realms of tolerability. I mean, good Lord, where does that end? I remember Eric Kaufman, you know, the political scientist there in London, gave a presentation I was at last year, in which he looked at the surveys of the Zoomers, Generation Z, in the UK and in the United States, and he said, we conservatives had better fight the culture war, because if this goes on much longer, there's not going to be any, the battle will be over, because the illiberal leftism that the Zoomers endorse is just overwhelming in that generation. And I think that so many boomers and people like me and Gen Xers just don't see it.
Well, I think that dark note. I asked for a note of hope. We just got more despair. Oh, well.
Okay, well, can I give you some hope? I give you some hope at the end. All right. In 2017, in 2018, I was in France doing book tour stuff. And I had coffee with a top French intellectual and an old Soixante Huitard, you know, a progressive secularist, but who had just been totally black-pilled by Islamism and everything in France. And I said, sir, professor, where do you find hope? He said, oh, I have no hope. I said, well, I do have hope. I'm a Christian and my hope is in Jesus Christ. But please don't think I'm saying that as like a simplistic TV evangelist. I'm very pessimistic about the future. But as a believing Christian, I believe that God is always with us, and that suffering, if we do it in the right way, and we don't let hate conquer our souls, suffering can be redemptive. And he listened to me seriously and respectfully, and he nodded and said, well, that's good for you Americans, but here in France, we don't believe in God. Oh, and he was totally serious. And the poor man was so smothered with despair. And I realized that, you know, this is it, that the Christian faith is the only means, I think, that most of us in the West have to get through this without losing our heads and losing our souls. And that's why, you know, as we descend further and further into cultural despair and gloom, I can't be totally despairing, because I believe firmly with all my heart that God is with us.
Well, I can only suggest that top French intellectuals throw away their berets and turtlenecks and pick up a copy of Charles Peggy, The Portal of the Mystery of Hope. And Well, thank you so much, Rod, for joining us. It's been a great pleasure, and thank you again for writing for The Critic. I hope to see you again in pages and in person.
Indeed. Thank you, Sebastian.
Thanks, Rob.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.